on 666 ABC Canberra. I'm Genevieve Jacobs. Now, what kind of care do you take of yourself? Are you reasonably careful about your diet, your exercise? Do you see that as an investment in your future well-being? Preventative healthcare, in fact, is one of the best investments of any kind, metaphorical or literal, that we can make in ourselves. But I think to the hair-tearing frustration of many, it's never been a really major priority for government. Now, why is that? Why is something as simple and straightforward as encouraging people to look after themselves physically and mentally not a major priority for our leaders? With me now for the second bite at the cherry that is economics and morals is the Australia Institute's Dr. Richard Dennis. Richard, good morning to you.
Good morning.
The beardlessness must be remarked upon.
When you said hair tearing, I wondered if that was a reference to
very little left either on the head or the chin now, Richard.
Smooth.
But I believe for those who've been seeing you on perhaps Sky last week or whatever, the reaction was overwhelmingly negative.
To those who say I never listen, I suggest I clearly did.
Moving right on. How would you describe preventative healthcare? What do you mean by that?
Look, preventative healthcare is obviously, you know, the old saying, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. If we really want people to be healthy, we can take actions, which might be medical or they might be cultural or behavioural, which prevent people from ill health, or we can treat them once they're experiencing ill health. And the medical evidence and the economic evidence suggests, well, it's a lot better for everybody, certainly the individuals, to prevent people from getting sick. So if we try to educate people about washing their hands, massive increase in public health and preventative health, washing hands, or you know, telling people what is a healthy or unhealthy diet, we can make massive differences to people's health.
Well, interesting to talk just the other week to Imogen Mitchell, Professor Imogen Mitchell from the Intensive Care Unit at the Canberra Hospital, who's got a Harkness Fellowship on implementing just exactly these kinds of quite basic safety procedures in hospitals and why people often don't do them, which is really remarkable. But preventative healthcare is a part of our healthcare thinking, but it's not our primary healthcare thinking mode, is it?
No, it's not the sexy part, it's not the powerful part, and it's certainly not where we spend most of our time or money. So, you know, fingers crossed no one listening has experience of this, but you have yourself a car accident, do yourself a lot of harm, you'll be whisked into a hospital, bells ring, lights flash, and teams of people will come and do everything they can to save your life. And let's face it, that's a great thing.
That's our expectation, though,
it
too.
Is absolutely.
That's what we want as voters,
we
to have
do.
That.
So that acute care is something we take very seriously. But we sell cars that go at 250 kilometres an hour. It is illegal to drive at more than 110. And while we want to spend a fortune making the roads safe and we want to spend a fortune on fixing people up after car accidents, you say, well, why are people driving at 180 kilometres an hour? Who sold them that car? And then all of a sudden, we don't want to have that conversation.
Oh, you know, it reminds me of a very interesting conversation I had with my husband on the weekend, Richard. We were reading in the Weekend Australian the article about Icaria, the Greek island of Icaria, where people live for a very, very long time. You know, having a little fantasy about a house on a Greek island, how lovely that
it's
would be.
It's too late.
It is too late, yes. but it does just strike me that people in places like that will often have very minimal health care.
Yes.
That's something that would make us in the developed, thriving, prosperous Western world very angry were we to be living under those circumstances, because we expect as a right that there will be bells and whistles and a lot of facilities. And yet the conundrum is, of course, that many of those people live longer and healthier and better lives than we do, because the very act of living in that particular way is preventative in and of itself.
Absolutely. And also Cuba is another great example. Yeah. Cuba has very low GDP per person. It's a poor country. But when you look at it, when you look at the health statistics, it's a standout. It's this poor country with very good figures for infant mortality and very good figures for longevity. And that's because Cuba can't afford the machines that go beep. Cuba can't afford the incredibly wonderful life-saving technology that we invest so much in. So they've done the exact opposite, and they intervene early. And at a cultural level and behavioural level, you know, the message is very clear.
And they also have a very well-educated population, and there's always been a focus on training doctors. But
yes,
in this case, the doctoring is done at that earlier level. I just wonder how this has developed over time, whether this is the medicalisation of ordinary good health.
It's the commercialisation of health, which I think is problematic. So anything that involves selling a solution, whether it's selling a pill or selling a medical intervention, we're actually the political and lobbying process does a pretty good job. Like if you can collect up some evidence that shows this pill will help people with heart disease, you'll have a pretty easy run at convincing politicians that they should fund your pill to prevent heart disease. But go and try and tell the same politician that discouraging people from eating something will cause heart disease, will help heart disease, and in turn those politicians should help to discourage people buying a particular product, and the politics will change quite dramatically. So, for example, if I came up with an immunisation for diabetes, the government would be queuing up to pay for it, because diabetes is a massive and growing problem. So if we could pay someone some money to prevent diabetes, there's no doubt the government would do it. But go and suggest we ban junk food advertising on children's viewing hours because kids are eating sugar in a box for breakfast, being told, relax, it's got vitamin B1 added to it and it's part of a healthy diet. All of the medical evidence says these kids shouldn't be eating these products. Go ask those same politicians that would spend $1 billion on a vaccine to spend not a cent banning the ads, and they'll run a mile.
But you're giving me a very broad definition of preventative healthcare there, aren't you?
Yes.
Because the argument would be that a diabetes vaccine is preventative healthcare.
It is, and so is changing your diet. And governments shouldn't, you know, if we're going to do evidence-based policy, and I've never seen much evidence that we do evidence-based policy, but if we're going to pretend to do evidence-based policy, the issue isn't what intervention is best. The question is, well, of all the things that could help solve this problem, which one looks like it would give the best bang for the buck? And banning junk food ads during children's viewing hours would cost the government nothing, and it would change people's food consumption. Now, some people still go on to get diabetes. We want to treat them. But if we can stop 100,000 people getting diabetes, we'll help them a lot. We'll save ourselves a fortune.
The man questioning one of the great truisms of government, that evidence-based decision-making is the way to go, that we ever really put that into practice, is Dr. Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute. And we're talking about preventative healthcare and trying to think through the moral and economic judgments that we make about this, that it's undoubtedly far and away the most effective way for us to be prosecuting our healthcare, but yet not one that's much of a vote winner, not one that gets an enormous amount of attention. Leon says about half the dudes in public toilets don't wash their hands. Indeed. Great to hear from you. If you've got some thoughts, 1300 681 666 is the number, and the SMS 0467 922 666. Now, Richard, of course, the question is that if we were to say, take that example of banning junk food advertisements on television, the people who lose out are the people who make contributions to political parties. And their argument is, and you can certainly make this argument, that it's not fair to that it's not fair to control free enterprise, that it's not fair to remove the economic benefits that that free enterprise has for our society as a whole, and that there are significant flow-on effects from that kind of rigid over-control on government's part.
Yeah, I love
this
argument.
Have a crack at that.
Oh, it's easy. We force car companies to put seatbelts in cars. We force them. Mm. We force people to wear them when they drive around. We pay police a fortune to check on you. And all that's for something as simple as putting on a seatbelt, which will save your life in an accident. The idea that we sort of leave everything up to the individual is bizarre. We force you to drive on the left-hand side of the road. We don't force you to wash your hands, but we do force you to drive in particular ways. And I call people that mount these arguments the glibertarians, because while they're libertarian when it comes to sugar in a box, they often support telling people who they can marry, you know, or whether they can have access to voluntary euthanasia. Or, you know, if you want to go libertarian, that's fine, but you buy it lock, stock and barrel. If you want me to be free to eat sugar for breakfast and someone be free to tell my kids that's healthy for them, then with that support for freedom comes a whole range of freedoms that people might want to reflect on. So I'm generally libertarian. I actually do like individuals making their own choices. But it's delusional to say that all choices are free. We don't let you have a gun. We don't let you drive on the right-hand side of the road. We force you to wear a seatbelt. And I can't set up a radio station and broadcast on this frequency because that would harm other people more than it would help them.
And also, we would never ask you to be our guest again. And that would be a shame all round.
And no one would hear me if you did. So.
Richard, in whose interests more generally is it to not encourage people to remain in good health all the time? Who are the stakeholders here?
Look, no one's actually... I'm not so cynical, and that's rare that I start a sentence like that, but I'm not so cynical that I think people are actually out there trying to hurt people. But there are people out there that want to sell breakfast cereal that's no good for you. And they're not really sitting there thinking, oh, I want to give people diabetes today. But they are saying, well, I've got a shareholders meeting coming up, and the profit I need to report needs to go up, or, you know, I might not get my bonus. So there are people out there that make money doing things that harm us, and there are people out there that make money trying to help us. But with preventative health, the thing is that a lot of the changes don't make money for anybody. And the politics of this are quite important, because if you open a new diabetes treatment clinic in Canberra, there'll be a ribbon to cut and you'll be lauded and what a great health minister you are. But no one in 20 years' time is going to say, gee, I'm in 12% better health than I might have otherwise expected 20 years ago. I wonder who the health minister was 20 years ago who introduced a range of preventative health policies. I really must send them a Christmas card. So the politics of preventative health are spend some money up front, save some money and save some lives in the future when no one will ever thank you for it. Whereas spend some money on a new acute care ward, and I'm not opposed to acute care wards, but spend some money opening something and you get political praise straight away.
Well, and let's admit too that the financial flow on from infrastructure development of that kind can be a significant economic driver. You're not just building a hospital, you're building jobs, you're paying... it's my job to be the devil's advocate
here.
Yeah,
I know.
Go
on. It's just such rubbish. Look, when you spend $100 million building something, you create jobs. If you build an acute care hospital or a school, it doesn't matter, you're still creating jobs. And every $100 million we spend on an acute care ward, which perhaps we could avoid with some preventative health, is $100 million we didn't spend on some other asset. So, of course, some jobs will be created building part of a hospital. Those same jobs will be created building any other bit of infrastructure. And this is, you know, where the economists do think about the money. We're a confused species. We jumped to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a vaccine for bird flu 5 or so years back because someone, you know, rightly said, well, if that came to Australia, that could spread like wildfire and people might die. So we spent, I think, around $400 million on that episode. That's $400 million we could have spent on Indigenous health.
But how do you make that judgment? How do you make that judgment politically? Because bird flu was an enormous fear at the time. And, you know, who knows why we avoided it? You know, luck, good controls at the airport, whatever other circumstances came into play. But if that $400 million had not been spent on the vaccines and the bird flu epidemic had taken place, you know, that's a disaster all round, isn't it?
Well, a disaster for the politician who didn't buy it. That's right. Look, it's a disaster that Indigenous people have 20 years less life expectancy than us. But it's a predictable disaster. It's a disaster that was there yesterday, it's there today, it'll be there tomorrow. But something new happening on your watch as a politician that you didn't take precautions against, that's a political disaster. So, look, we do have to take precautions against things like bird flu. My point is that we're not very consistent. You know, we completely ignore medical evidence that says ban junk food advertising for kids. We completely ignore road statistics that say, you know, preventing people from driving that fast would save. We completely ignore that evidence. But when someone waves another bit of evidence under our nose that says, oh, bird flu might come, we jump at it. And it comes back to what we talked about last week. The biggest ethical choice in economics is whether to ask the economists or not. The economists weren't asked about bird flu. They would have multiplied, you know, the very small probability of it happening by, you know, the benefit of having it and said, look, there are better investments in health. But the politicians knew, wow, if I ask the economists, they'll tell me not to do it, so I won't ask.
But we do have some very effective preventative healthcare messages, and we've just been hearing the news today, for example, that 70% of Australians now say that they would prefer not to get a suntan, that they no longer deliver... I mean, you know, it has taken us 30 years to get there with that one. I was talking to Tom Calmer earlier about the really big effort that's going into dealing with smoking in Indigenous communities. Is it really fair to say that there's not a meaningful level of investment in helping people to save themselves? It does happen.
It does happen. No, sorry. I'm not saying we don't do any. Yeah. And Australia's response to AIDS was world class.
Yeah.
You know, fantastic. We acted early and we acted decisively. No, I think smoking and sunscreen are two quite different but interesting examples. Think about, I mean, get Simon Chapman on air and ask him how hard it was.
Yeah.
To get those cigarette ads off telly, and that'll tell you why we're still advertising the sugar in the box.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the evidence that got the preventative health anti-smoking strategy up and over the line, whereas with skin cancer, I think that's quite different.
Yeah.
There is money to be made selling sunscreen, so there is an industry out there that's very happy, you know, to reinforce the public health message. There's no pushback. But I do think that there's very strong cultural norms reinforced by media depictions that suntans are good looking and healthy.
Mm. But I take your point that there's no economic driver on the sun's behalf,
no,
as it were.
No.
So we just go out there and do that to ourselves.
Yes.
Doris called to say how much she's enjoying this segment, and Robin also called to ask, taking it, I guess, a further step in the notion of what preventative healthcare really is. Robin called to ask what responsibility supermarkets have in the health impacts of selling cheap, bad food, you know, the 2-for-1 chocolate bars and the like.
Okay, well, their responsibility, and I'm not being cynical, this is just accurate, their responsibility is to make as much money as they can. That's their job. Let's just be really clear about this. And if someone starts to suggest that maybe we should regulate them in some way, then they might pretend that they've got another job, which is to be responsible. Their job's to sell stuff. The trolleys are getting bigger. You know, you think about
they
the number.
They are, aren't they? Oh, they really are. Yeah.
Think about the number of times you've popped in to buy something at the supermarket and you graze your way around the aisles. And you leave and you can barely carry the stuff to the car. Mm. You didn't think you'd bought much. Mm. And that's because the trolleys are bigger than they used to be. It's their job to sell us stuff.
Yeah.
So, look, if we think that they've got a responsibility, then we actually have to be articulate about what that responsibility is and impose it on them. They'll fight it tooth and nail in the same way they fought the plastic ban bags. Mm. They don't want people writing shopping lists and coming to the shop to get what they plan to buy. That's why they give us bags for free. But they sell bags in aisle 5. Why do you think they want to give them to you for free? Because they don't want you to think before you come.
Yeah.
They want you to show up, wander around and pick up some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, good luck to them. They're making good money doing it. But if we think they've got a role to play, we need to say what that role is.
Linnell has made the astute observation that this sounds like the difference between parenting and the favourite aunt who turns up bearing gifts. That's actually, as a social observation, I think that's actually absolutely bang on the money. This is exactly what we're talking about our personal responsibility, which goes back to your evocation of libertarian politics. Richard, could you change the way that you market preventative healthcare in the community? Because obviously people have to think there are votes in this to make it worth their while.
Look, you can, but it's in no one's interests to do so. I mean, if you and I are political rivals and you're using evidence to make decisions that upset media and breakfast cereal companies, and I'm using politics to say the hospital waiting lists are just too long and the government's trying to distract us from their incompetence, I'm going to beat you. We as voters would have to be more sophisticated and more willing to look at the issues. But I guess for me, the best way to win this fight over time is to tackle the biggest nonsense, and that is that preventative health is a good idea, but that we can't afford it. Now, that's like saying, I can't afford to put oil in my car, I'll just get my engine reconditioned in a month's time. If you can't afford to put oil in your car, don't drive your car. To suggest that somehow fiscally responsible or thinking about the long-term economic interests to not spend money on something that'll save you a fortune is such economic nonsense that, well, it would be laughable if the joke wasn't on the public. So the point is, preventative health will save taxpayers a fortune in the future. We know this. And it's preventable. That's why we're talking about it. So it's kind of bizarre to me as an economist to hear these sort of arguments where people agree with you in principle. Oh, yes, Richard, nodding, very good. We should do that preventative health. But you realise there's no money. It's like, wait, so you'd prefer to spend 10 times as much in a few years, would you? So if we want to shift the politics, I'd shift it on the economics.
And in the meantime, here in the 666 studios, the message is to lay off the junk food and get plenty of exercise.
Well,
and do you better on every imaginable couch.
Well, and don't be too stressed. So enjoy the junk food you do eat, you know, and don't sit on the couch at night thinking I should have gone to the gym. You know, it becomes all 0-1. You know, it's not, we don't have to be perfect to be better. And that's what the preventative health stuff really says. I mean, there's great evidence that says being active is more important than being thin. So yeah. Don't worry that you're overweight. If you're overweight and walking every day, you are doing far more and you are putting far more years on your life than if you're overweight thinking, I don't think I can ever lose all this weight. It doesn't matter. Go and do some exercise and you'll be better off.
Richard, just lovely to have you here again to unpack this one, which is such a puzzle. And as you say, it's so simple and straightforward in many senses, the equation, and so curious that we don't implement this more frequently. But thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we will meet again very soon. Time now for the news headlines, and it's good morning to Clarissa Thorpe.